He was supposed to suggest all the ways he would make a better boyfriend than Roy. So Dwight, Rain, approached me and kneeled down very close to my face, like very close, and launched into a long, spontaneous monologue about a girlfriend who was fighting in Iraq. He went on and on and on. In addition to naming all the ways he was a great boyfriend, he also talked about some of the ways he could win a knife fight. I didn't say anything. I just listened. I remember thinking about possums, how they freeze when they sense danger. It seemed like this might be Pam's motivation in this bizarre encounter. The less she said, the less she moved, the more quickly the strange man will go away. When it was finally over, I thought it went great. It felt seamless, and I loved working with Rain. But then they never asked me to audition with him again. I was afraid it was because I had broken character and laughed at one point, but I couldn't help it. He was so funny. During the final season of The Office, the producers found our network test tapes. We all huddled around as a cast and watched them together. It was actually kind of amazing. The casting was crystal clear. The chemistry, the quirks, the humor, we were those lovable characters. I couldn't believe it. To think back, all those crazy elements had come together for me. The right timing, right height, right hair color, and total lack of name value. It was lightning in a bottle. One of the scenes on those tapes was between me and Steve Carell, who was obviously testing for office manager Michael Scott. In the scene, Michael was interrupting Pam's lunch to tell her about his doctor's visit to test for testicular cancer. It was so funny. Steve timed the most uncomfortable details of his story perfectly. Sometimes it was just as I was about to take a bite of my sandwich. Sometimes on the swallow. Sometimes just as I was raising it to my lips. My favorite was the time you can see me waiting and wondering if it's safe to take a bite. I pause, he pauses, I bite, and he says something gross. I would come to learn this is the brilliance of Steve Carell. Precision. He is a master of comic timing. He hits the bullseye every time. None of us expected the show to take off like it did. After we shot the pilot, we all hugged goodbye and handed out scrapbooks. We were expecting to never see one another again. The show just seemed too weird or too different or too something to ever make it on the air. Don't get me wrong. We knew it was good. In fact, I was fairly certain it was the very best thing I would ever have the opportunity to do. But never in our wildest dreams did we think we'd get to do it for nearly 10 years. Keep in mind, at this point, I had been clawing away for 8 years, so I knew better than to get my hopes up. And I wasn't alone. Everyone was struggling gig to gig, paycheck to paycheck. Steve got his start with the comedy group The Second City in Chicago. He'd done countless pilots and had been struggling on and off as an actor for almost 20 years. He'd been a regular correspondent on The Daily Show and had a memorable scene in the Jim Carrey movie Bruce Almighty. He was well-respected in the industry, but far from a household name. Rain was a classically trained theater actor. He'd been struggling for 15 years. He'd done dozens of guest appearances and traveled the country doing theater. But at that point, his biggest job was a recurring role on the HBO show 6 Feet Under. John Krasinski had only been out of college for a few years. He had done some commercials and some guest spots, but nothing significant. The supporting cast members all had similar stories. We all needed a break. When we finished the pilot, we were told the network would make a final decision sometime before May 15th. I waited for the phone to ring every day for months. Finally, on May 14th at 7 p.m., the network called to say we were picked up. They were ordering 5 more episodes. We all had jobs. Chapter 5. You got a job. How things work on a television or film set. First of all, I choose the great roles. And if none of those come, I choose the mediocre ones. And if they don't come, I choose the ones that pay the rent. Michael Caine. No matter how successful you become, there is nothing quite like the moment when you get your first speaking role in film or television. I had been struggling in Los Angeles for 5 years when it finally happened for me. It was an episode of the television show Spin City, when Charlie Sheen was the star, and I played the role of a young lady who worked in a restaurant. Here's what I knew about the character. Her name was Waitress. She wore a white shirt and black pants. In the episode, Charlie Sheen goes on a double date with Heather Locklear, Vanessa Marcel, and Scott Wolf. They go to a restaurant where, at one point, Vanessa Marcel goes berserk and throws a dinner roll at the waitress. Me. I had three lines. I'm not sure it's possible for a person to spend more time working on three lines as I did for those on Spin City. I remember spending a particularly long time on the line, "Is Pepsi okay?" in response to Vanessa's request for a Coke. Should I start to turn away and then turn back and ask? Should I ask as if I was bored? How would Lisa Kudrow do it? I went on to create a whole backstory for Waitress. It's a busy night. I've been working a double shift. My boss is looking over my shoulder. Oh. All kinds of crazy preparation just to ask about Pepsi and have a dinner roll thrown at my back. Some things I remember about the shoot. It was shot on a studio lot. I had a special drive-on pass, which made me feel important and which I saved in my scrapbook. Heather Locklear was strikingly beautiful, and she talked to everyone. The hair and makeup people loved her. Charlie Sheen kept to himself. I had never seen so many snack foods in my life. They were everywhere. They even brought a tray of snacks into the hair and makeup trailer while I was getting ready. I pigged out. See you later, actor's pizza. I remember waiting around forever after hair and makeup. I wasn't sure what we were waiting for because no one really updated me. Having nothing else to do, I used the time to snack. After about an hour, the actors were called to set. I was stuffed and nervous, a dangerous combination. Then, just as we were about to start, there was another delay and we had to wait on set. The other actors seemed relaxed and started chatting. I didn't know if I was supposed to talk with them or not. I mean, they were all stars and I was just a day player with three lines. I could hear everything they were saying even though they were talking amongst themselves. I remember they were discussing a recent story from the tabloids and all the reasons it wasn't true. I couldn't help but eavesdrop. They had such awesome inside information. At some point, I decided to break in and add my own two cents. I quickly regretted this decision. Heather Locklear was very kind. She acknowledged me and drew me in for a sentence or two, and everyone else sort of followed her lead. But it was awkward. That's when I learned there is a difference between the regular actors and the guest actors on a television show. I was like the new girlfriend at a family dinner where everyone starts talking old family gossip. Best not to talk in that situation. Just listen. I stood there, sweating bullets, hoping I wasn't going to get fired or throw up. If only I could have known that in three more years I'd be rubbing Scott Wolf's back in a scene for our hit comedy pilot Rubbing Charlie. Maybe then I would have felt more confident. Once we started shooting, everything went by very fast. I said my lines to the director's satisfaction. I kept a respectful distance from the other actors. I ate even more delicious food. And when the episode aired a month later, all three of my lines made the show. I learned a few things from that shoot that remain true to this day. 1. Most of your day is spent waiting around. 2. The most prepared person on a set is the person who has three lines. 3. If you are the person with three lines, you're supposed to act like you can't hear what the stars on set are saying around you. 4. Sets have lots of food. So, now it's your turn. Let's pretend you got your first speaking role on a film or television show. First, let me congratulate you. Yay, you did it! You got the job! Congratulations! I assume you've already called your parents and taken a thumbs-up selfie and texted it to all your friends. If you haven't done those things, do them now. Brag. Celebrate. This is a big deal. You've been working really hard for this. Just be sure not to mention any details about your new job on social media. Productions are very sensitive about information leaks regarding plots, characters, and shoot locations. I actually know someone who got fired for posting about a new job. She tweeted that she'd booked a great guest spot on a popular television show and then named the actor she'd be working with. The network considered the post a spoiler and recast her. Likewise, when you get to your new job, no photos. Can you sneak a selfie in your trailer for your personal scrapbook? Sure, but I wouldn't post it online. And definitely, definitely do not take photos of yourself on set or of the other actors on set. That's a big no-no, and it could land you in serious trouble. Let's talk about what you can expect going forward, now that you've booked a job. If you've booked a guest role on a television show, there's a good chance you'll start shooting in the next day or two. If you've landed a movie role, you'll probably have a bit longer before reporting to work. This is because movies usually have a longer pre-production period than a TV show. Movies typically shoot over 30, 60, or 90 days, as opposed to TV, which is usually a week-long shoot. In either case, the preparation starts immediately. Table reads. Before shooting begins, you might be invited to attend a table read. A table read is when the entire cast is assembled in a room filled with studio executives, producers, and writers, and the script is read aloud. Table reads are more common in television shows and big-budget films. Independent, smaller-budget movies may or may not have a table read, simply because they don't have the resources to schedule and pay the actors in advance of the shoot. Television table reads usually happen 1 week before shooting. On movies, it could be up to a month in advance. If you're asked to participate in a table read, you'll be reading from the most recent version of the script. You'll most likely be given this draft of the script once you arrive at the reading. Perhaps you've already been working with an earlier draft, highlighting your lines and making notes in the margins. Feel free to arrive early and transfer any of these important details to the new script, should you feel like they would be useful for you in the reading. I always like to arrive early and highlight my lines. But definitely use the script they hand you on the day, not your own from home, because it is very likely that changes have been made. A table read should sound like the movie or TV show will sound, in terms of the performances. So, despite the fact that you're sitting at a table with a script in your hands, be sure to give as full a vocal performance as possible. Don't just read the words. Be animated. Make the script come alive. Listen to your fellow actors and try to match the energy in the room. Not to make you nervous, but I know people who have been fired after a table read. If the producers feel like something about you or the character is off, they might fire you and reimagine things. One of my early jobs was as a replacement for an actor who was let go after a table read. Also, table reads are not the arena for you to try a new take on the character. Do the things that got you the job in the first place. Stay consistent. I love table reads. They're generally a very positive experience. It's a chance to meet the actors and members of the creative team. The writers get to hear if the dialogue is working and if the arcs in the story make sense. And people laugh at the jokes. We had a table read every single week on The Office. Tuesdays, after lunch, we all assembled in the writer's trailer and read the script for the following week. Sometimes our guest actors joined us, sometimes they didn't. If you're not invited to a table read, don't fret. Guest roles are often cast after the table read has occurred. This is especially true of smaller roles because small characters often get altered or cut based on the table read. This was true on The Office. Because things would change so much after the table read, they would wait to cast smaller roles until later in the week. In general, after a table read is over, the actors are dismissed and the director, writers, and producers stay behind to discuss the script. If you have a lingering question, table it. Aw, yeah, a pun. While this might seem like a good time to chat up the director and ask your question, it's actually not. You should exit with the other actors. Wardrobe. Shortly after you get the good news from your agent, you'll start getting phone calls from various members of the production team. You probably think your first call might be from the director or producer, but it's usually from someone in the wardrobe department. Once, I even found out about a job because the wardrobe person called me and started asking me questions. My agent called to tell me I'd booked the job 30 minutes later. Crazy, right? Wardrobe will need to know your clothing sizes and may even want to set a wardrobe fitting with you before you start work. When they ask your sizes, tell the truth. If you're somewhere between a medium and a large, tell them this. Don't just say medium. And don't tell them what size you hope to be by the time you start shooting. Tell them the size you are now. There is nothing more embarrassing than getting to a fitting where everything is too small because you didn't want to admit your real sizes. Most wardrobe departments have a tailor on hand to make things smaller, but they can't make stuff bigger. Be prepared to bring your own clothes. Even though it's a SAG-AFTRA job and you've entered the big time, it's possible you'll still have to wear your own stuff. In fact, I think every actor, male and female, should own a business suit that fits them well. If you are playing a lawyer, real estate agent, or a business executive, there's a good chance you will be asked to bring a suit to the fitting. And there are certain things I bring to every fitting, even if they don't ask. I always bring a nude bra, nude undies, black undies, and a thong. You never know what you might be asked to wear, and having undergarments that fit well are important. I also think it's a good idea, especially for women, to bring a few pairs of your own shoes. The last thing you want is to get stuck standing in uncomfortable shoes all day. Finally, I like to bring my favorite pair of jeans. Finding a great fitting pair of jeans is not easy, as we all know. When you're only working one or two days on a project, the wardrobe department doesn't have time to search high and low for the perfect pair of jeans for you. Even now, it's still the same. I recently did a one-day guest role on a TV show. I brought my own jeans to the fitting and ended up wearing them on the show. At most fittings, a wardrobe person and several assistants watch as you undress and try on various outfits. Everyone talks about what fits, what's flattering, and what isn't. It can be a little unnerving, especially for a modest person who doesn't love getting undressed in front of other people, like me. I often ask for privacy to change, especially if an outfit requires me to remove or change my bra or underwear. It's totally okay to ask people to leave while you change. Your fitting will likely feel rushed. This is normal, as everyone on set is always in a time crunch. That said, it's perfectly acceptable for you to have reasonable opinions about the clothes you are wearing. If you feel like something is unflattering or not your character, say so. I'll say something like, "This wouldn't be my first choice." Or, "I don't love this one." Sometimes I still end up wearing things that don't quite feel right, but I try to speak up if I really hate something. Ultimately, you are the one in front of the camera, so make sure that you feel comfortable. The last thing you want is to be distracted by some element of your wardrobe while you're trying to act. If you've ever wondered why actors seem to obsess about their weight, it's because of the dreaded fitting. Your size is not a private affair. My manager has my sizes on file in her office. Height, weight, pant, dress, bra, waist, hip, and shoe are all standard requests. When I book a job, she forwards my sizes to the wardrobe department, and someone shops for my costumes based on this information. In a normal job, if you gain or lose a few pounds, it's no big deal. Just grab your fat jeans and blousy top and vow to get to the gym more often. But in this business, you have to tell someone you've gained weight so that the next time you go to a fitting, the clothes are the right size. Take, for example, the email I send to my manager after every holiday season. "Happy New Year, Naomi. Just wanted to let you know I enjoyed the holidays, including lots of my mom's snowball cookies. I'm now a size 6 pant instead of a 4. Talk soon." Emails go out to the agents, stylists, and wardrobe department. "Jenna would like everyone to know that she is now a 6 pant." Such fun. When I was on The Office, Pam had her own closet in the wardrobe office. It was filled with pencil skirts, button-down tops, and cardigans. Each week, the wardrobe department would pull a skirt, top, and sweater for me to wear. If my sizes suddenly changed, nothing would fit. Luckily, they knew me and my sweet tooth. They kept a few bigger skirts on hand so I'd have something to wear after Christmas break. My character in the film Walk Hard had something like 90 different costumes, many of which were skimpy lingerie. Before the shoot, the studio hired a personal trainer and nutritionist who promptly put me on a very strict diet and exercise plan. Since movies shoot their scenes out of sequence, I had to stay the same size for the duration of the shoot so that my character looked consistent. The slightest change in my weight could throw off all the continuity. This was the first time I'd experienced my figure being such an essential element to a character. It was fun. I was being paid to work out. I mean, it was my job to have a rockin' bod. By the time we were ready to start shooting, I was in the best shape of my life. I can't really take credit. If you cut out sugar, caffeine, bread, complex carbs, saturated fats, dessert, and alcohol, and train 2 hours a day, 6 days a week for 3 months, it's impossible not to look pretty amazing. My wardrobe fit me perfectly. One of my costumes was a custom-made horse riding outfit with hand-sewn sequins and beading. It was spectacular. About 3/4 of the way through the shoot, I hit a wall. I was so sick of eating quinoa and grilled chicken and steamed vegetables. Every meal was so boring. Oh, and berries for dessert. I just like to say, berries are not a dessert. I'm happy to eat them, but don't tell me they're a dessert. Just tell me I'm eating chicken, quinoa, vegetables, a side of berries, and nothing for dessert. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yes, we're about 3/4 of the way through the shoot. We are shooting on location. I'm staying in a hotel in the desert. It's late at night, and I'm starving. I peruse the boring, prepackaged microwave meal from my nutritionist, and I realize I can't put another lump of gray grilled chicken into my mouth. I stare at the room service menu. Should I do it? I figure the shoot's almost over, and it's only one meal, right? I'll go back to Bland City tomorrow. So I text my co-star, Chris Parnell. Hey, do you want to get burgers from room service and watch a movie? His text back was the greatest I've ever received. Sure. I pick up the phone and order a giant cheeseburger with fries, wine, and a Diet Coke. Yes, I ordered wine and a Diet Coke. I might have also ordered an ice cream sundae for dessert. Or two. I get to work the next day and realize we're shooting the horse riding scene, the one with the tight-fitting custom riding outfit. Oh, no. I walk in my trailer, and there it is, in all its beaded glory, taunting and daring me to try it on. So I put on the pants. Well, sort of put on the pants, because they won't zip. I'm not kidding. They will not zip up. It's like I gained 5 pounds overnight. My body must have been so excited to have real food, it decided to save it to my hips immediately. I called the wardrobe woman into my trailer. What happened? She said. I ate a burger, I said sheepishly. Okay, don't worry, she said. I'll find something. She dug around and came back with a generic black riding outfit. As she handed it to me, I could tell she was heartbroken. It wasn't nearly as cool as the custom one. When I walked on set, the director had to be told about the wardrobe change, as he had approved the original outfit. I was so embarrassed. And then there's the woman who sewed the custom one, who wouldn't get to see her handiwork on screen anymore. All because I ate a burger. No wonder so many actors and models have eating disorders. Your size and weight are constantly on display, constantly being scrutinized. It can be very stressful, not to mention shameful. Luckily, I'm not often cast in roles that require me to wear a bikini, and I don't have food issues. I eat regular meals and real desserts, not berries. But that doesn't mean I don't also feel pressure to stay in good physical shape and maintain a consistent size. It's not about being tiny. The point is, whatever your size, you want to stay consistent, at least for the duration of whatever role or project you are working on. If you take on a role with certain physical requirements, make sure you can realistically maintain them for the entire shoot. Resist the temptation to pack on pounds, yo-yo diet, and do crazy cleanses. It's not healthy. Your body is your instrument. You need to treat it kindly. People come in all shapes and sizes, and so do characters. Embrace a healthy size that feels easy to maintain and go from there. Props, eating, and smoking. If your character has to eat food in a scene, the props department will be the people in charge of providing the food. They may call and ask if you have any food allergies. Obviously, tell the truth. If you have a major food aversion, like you vomit every time you smell salmon, be honest and tell them. I'm sure you really don't want to throw up on set, and they don't want you to either. Even if the scene calls for salmon, they can develop something else that will work. When you shoot a scene, you don't just do it once. It takes hours, over and over from different angles to shoot a scene. If you have a scene at a dinner table, you won't just have to eat dinner once, you'll have to eat dinner all day. So if props gives you a food choice, ask for something light. Keep in mind that they'll serve you cooked food but chilled. If you're having chicken parmesan, it will be fully cooked, but served cold so that it won't go bad under the hot lights. Keep this in mind. Only eat when absolutely necessary. I remember the first time I was asked what I'd like to eat in a scene. We were shooting on location at a restaurant. They gave me a menu and told me to pick a meal. There was steak on the menu. I was a starving artist, so I sheepishly said, "Steak and potatoes?" They said, "Sure thing." I was so excited. Not only did I have a job, but I was going to eat free steak. Cut to hour 8 of me eating cold steak and potatoes. Oh my God, I was so sick. And so full. Now, I order salad or penne pasta. Never, ever, ever steak again. This reminds me of the time on The Office when the cast had to eat mint chocolate chip ice cream cake. In season 1, we had an episode called The Alliance, where Michael forces the party planning committee to plan a birthday party for Meredith. He then instructs them to serve mint chocolate chip ice cream cake, disregarding the fact that Meredith is lactose intolerant, because it's his favorite cake. So, on the day, we started filming the party scenes around 7:30 a.m. Mindy Kaling and I were in the background of the scene, very excited to be eating cake at work, especially mint chocolate chip ice cream cake. We were taking huge bites, one after the other, basically stuffing our faces. Steve Carell saw us and offered a warning. "Guys, you may want to ease up on the cake. Maybe fake it a few times, especially because you're in the background. You don't want to get sick." Did Mindy and I pay attention to this sound advice? Nope. We just kept shoveling mint chocolate chip ice cream cake into our faces. By 9 a.m., I was bouncing off the walls with a sugar high, laughing hysterically and ruining takes. I must have been so annoying to everyone in the cast. Then, at lunchtime, I started crashing. I was so full of that minty cake, I couldn't eat any real food. I started to feel sick and lay down in my trailer. But after a few minutes, I was called back to set. By now, I was feeling totally queasy and close to crying, and I swore in the future I would always pretend to eat food when I was in the background of a scene. I walked on set and realized there were more cake scenes to shoot. Only now, instead of being in the background, it was time for my close-ups, which meant I couldn't pretend to eat the cake. I had to devour it. Just holding the plate of cake made my stomach turn. I didn't know it was possible to hate cake as much as I now hated mint chocolate chip ice cream cake. I was gagging every take. At 6 p.m., the day was finally over. I went home and went to bed, feeling bloated and disgusting. The next morning, I got to work, ready to move on from yesterday's debacle. Well, guess what I was handed when I walked on set? Another piece of mint chocolate chip ice cream cake. Yep. It took us 2 full days to shoot the party scenes. 2 days of that awful mint chocolate chip ice cream cake. If you watch the episode, you barely see anyone eating cake. It all ended up on the cutting room floor. Hilarious. I ate all that cake and it never even made it into the episode. And now I hate ice cream cake. I recently asked Angela Kinsey, who played Angela, how she got through those days of shooting the birthday cake scenes. She told me that she and Phyllis Smith, who played Phyllis, had a bucket under one of the desks, and at the end of every take, they would spit any unswallowed cake into the bucket. These buckets are actually common in scenes that require eating. They're called spit buckets, and I don't know why I didn't use one in the scene. If you have a scene with lots of eating, I suggest you be like Angela and Phyllis and look for the spit bucket. The same logic that applies to picking your meal applies to scenes that require smoking. If you don't have to smoke in a scene, I wouldn't volunteer to do so. Smoking even an herbal cigarette becomes difficult after 8 hours. Free food. If you couldn't tell already, I like food. If you ask me, the best part of booking an acting gig when you're a starving artist is the free food. As long as it's not mint chocolate chip ice cream cake. There are 2 ways to get food on set. Catering and craft services. Meals are provided by catering. Craft services, or crafty, means snacks. There are usually 2 hot catered meals provided each day by catering. Breakfast, your meal upon arrival, and lunch. If you arrive first thing in the morning, a production assistant will ask you for a breakfast order. You can order pretty much anything you want. My favorite is 2 scrambled eggs with a side of turkey bacon, if they have it, a bowl of fruit, and a coffee with milk. Don't be afraid to ask for food. It's part of the SAG-AFTRA agreement. They have to feed you. If you're on a lower budget production, they may direct you to a buffet, which will usually have things such as oatmeal, cold cereals, bagels, muffins, eggs, juice, and coffee. If you are on a super-duper low-budget production, all bets are off. You might just get a plate of muffins. Lunch is served 6 hours after crew call. Crew call is the time that the crew arrives on set. Actors are usually told to arrive before the crew to go through hair and makeup. So, quick math. If you arrive at 5:30 a.m., but the crew arrives at 7 a.m., then lunch is at 1 p.m. But let's say you're doing a midday shoot and the crew arrives at noon. Lunch is at 6 p.m. Even though it's being served at 6 p.m., everyone will call it lunch. If you hear someone talking about crafty, they're talking about the snack table. Crafty is usually located close to set and has coffee, water, soft drinks, fruit, nuts, gum, and other little treats. If it's a big budget production, it may have hot food options too. On The Office, our craft services department served a hot snack twice a day. Sometimes the hot snack was as big as a meal. They would serve tacos, hot dogs, pasta, Thai food, homemade soup. They really went all out. On low budget productions, craft services is probably a bunch of bananas and a bowl of cashews. But the point is, if you need something to munch on, just ask for craft services. If you are an extra, you are generally not allowed to eat off of the craft services table. This is reserved for the crew and union actors with speaking roles. If you have special dietary needs, like you're gluten-free, vegetarian, or have food allergies, consider packing your own food just in case they don't have what you need. Preparation and the night before. The night before you're scheduled to work, a member of the production team will call and communicate your call time, or arrival time, for the next day. You will also be provided directions to the set, instructions on where to park, and what scenes you'll be doing that day. Most of the time, you won't receive this phone call until the end of the production's workday, which is usually anywhere from 7 to 10 p.m. Hopefully, you've already been sent a script. If not, ask the caller how you can get your hands on one. This is also a good time to ask if there have been any changes made to the script. It's not unusual to receive new script pages with all new dialogue the night before or upon your arrival the next morning. In fact, each morning when you arrive on set, they'll hand you a small packet of papers called sides. Remember those from your auditions? The sides they hand you on set include the most updated version of each scene that's being shot on that day, as well as the day's schedule. Read the sides. Don't assume they match the script you were sent earlier. Changes can and do happen all the time. I recently did a guest appearance on a television show produced by Greg Garcia called The Guest Book, playing a doctor specializing in Alzheimer's disease. In one scene, I had to deliver a 3-page speech to a boardroom full of people, a long monologue that included all sorts of complicated medical jargon and statistics. I spent an entire week working on it, perfecting my lines and performance. When I showed up on set, I started joking with the assistant director about how prepared I was, telling him I'd nail the whole thing in a couple of takes. He was very happy to hear this because it meant he'd make up for time lost earlier in the day. Then the director approached and asked if I wanted a rehearsal. I jokingly scoffed and said he should shoot the rehearsal because I was ready to go. He was thrilled. And we all got into position. We started rolling, and I launched into my epic medical monologue. I got a few lines in, and the director stopped me and asked if I was joking. I laughed and said no. I figured he was messing with me after I was so overconfident moments before. He then told me something was wrong because I was doing the wrong script. I laughed again, but then got a little nervous when he wasn't laughing back. A long silence followed as the director and assistant director whispered to each other. Finally, the director looked up at me and asked if I got the new script, the one that was sent a few days before. No. He went on to apologize, saying that they had to rewrite the entire monologue for legal reasons, then proceeded to hand me brand new pages. I read silently over the new pages and was horrified. It was an all new speech. And here I had been bragging about how prepared I was, when in fact I was completely in the dark. I freaked out and apologized, saying it was my fault. I must not have looked at the new pages they had sent out or the sides today because I was so overconfident. Long silence as everybody looked around the room. I then said, if they could give me a quiet space for 30 minutes, I could memorize the new script and be ready. And thanks to my training, I was able to do pretty well. The director also suggested we shoot the speech in sections, which was helpful, but also cost valuable time on a day when we didn't have much to spare. This entire embarrassing fiasco could have been avoided if I just read the latest script and prepared properly. It's not easy to navigate all the changes and keep your focus. And this is just the beginning. It's not just scripts that change. Schedules change too. Almost every time I book a job, I find out around 8 p.m. that I need to report the following day at 6 a.m. Totally normal. Also totally stressful. I used to think, how am I supposed to know what to prepare when I find out so late the night before? The best approach is to have all your work ready to go no matter what. Something to know about film sets is that things are always changing at the last minute. They might tell you, tomorrow we are shooting scene 16 at the carnival. But you get to the set, find out that someone is sick or they lost a location or it's raining, and now you need to shoot the indoor kitchen scenes instead. I remember once I was expecting to work in a scene where I only had one or two lines. I wasn't concerned at all. It seemed like an easy day at work. But when I arrived, I was told that the lead actor of those scenes was sick and not able to come to work, so they had decided to shoot one of my scenes that was scheduled for later in the week. It was a scene with tons of dialogue. I sort of knew my lines, but hadn't really fine-tuned my performance. I panicked and started cramming right away. Luckily, by the time they called me to set for the scene, I was ready. Now, I make sure I have my whole role fully prepared on day one. And I read every script and every set of sides each morning, so I'm ready for anything. The workday begins. Your arrival. A typical day of shooting usually lasts 12 to 14 hours and begins around 6 a.m., meaning you have to be there at 6 a.m. You should plan to arrive showered, with no makeup and clean hair. You might want to blow dry, style your hair the way you like it. If you have a smaller role, the stylist probably won't spend a lot of time on you, unless it's a period piece or there's a specific hair reference in the script. Men, if you auditioned with facial hair, arrive with facial hair. Otherwise, arrive clean shaven. If you forget, the makeup department will give you a razor and shaving cream, but they aren't the best razors, so better to shave at home. Allow a lot of extra time to get to the set and park. I find that about 70% of the time, some portions of the directions I've been given are incorrect. If I'm shooting on a studio lot, about 50% of the time, my name isn't at the gate as promised, and I have to wait while they call someone to verify my entrance. Sometimes the parking is very far from the set and requires a shuttle to take you from parking to your trailer at base camp. Build in time for traffic, wrong directions, confusing signs, and a long walk or van ride from parking to base. Your call time is the time you're expected to land at base camp, not the time you park your car. Keep that in mind. Each day, a production report is written up and sent to the studio, listing all of the hiccups from the set on that particular day. You don't want your name on that report. If you're late, it goes on the report as talent was late, no matter what the circumstances. It won't say talent was late because we failed to give them accurate directions, sent them 30 minutes out of their way, and then forgot to leave their name at the gate. It just says talent was late. When you arrive at base camp, you will most likely be greeted by a PA or production assistant. If you aren't, find one and introduce yourself. PAs are the people running around with little headsets in their ears, like their Secret Service. Make sure they know you have a speaking role and are not an extra. I can't tell you how many guest actors wind up in the extras holding area because they're too shy to explain they have a speaking role that day. The PA will show you to your trailer and give you a moment to get settled. If you have a SAG speaking role in a TV show or movie, no matter the size of the role, you get a trailer or private dressing room. In general, the size of your trailer is directly proportional to the size of your role. Most day players get placed in a honey wagon, which is a trailer divided into 5 private dressing rooms. This will be a teeny tiny room, but it's all yours, so enjoy. If you are working on a SAG low-budget movie, they are not obligated to give you a trailer or private room. You may be placed in a group holding area or green room instead. However, you must be provided with a private place to change clothes. After showing you to your trailer, the PA will likely present you with tax forms and a hard copy of your contract to sign. You will want to come prepared with your driver's license and Social Security card or passport. You will need to complete these forms before you are allowed to step on set. Next, you will be taken to the wardrobe department, especially if you haven't already had a fitting. After your wardrobe meeting, it'll be on to hair and makeup, then back to your trailer to sit and wait until they're ready for your scene. You might wait 1 hour. You might wait 5 hours. You might wait 10. When I was working on the film Blades of Glory, there was a day I waited in my trailer for 12 hours, only to be sent home because they never got to my scene. I just sat there, all dolled up in my full hair, makeup, and wardrobe, waiting. Actors hate waiting. It's boring, and it drains your energy and momentum. Not to mention, the anticipation makes it hard to really relax. I've tried reading, I've tried writing, I've tried scrapbooking. None of it really works. I'm constantly distracted, wondering when they're going to knock on my door and tell me they're ready. I feel like I'm a boxer, waiting for the bell to ring. I try to look at my lines or study my scene. Sometimes I return emails, but mostly I wind up sitting there with a weird combination of bored anticipation. There's a famous line among actors in the movie business. They pay me to wait. I do the acting for free. It's true, because the excruciating part of the job is the waiting. It feels like torture. Unless, of course, you're lucky enough to get a big tricked-out trailer like I had on Blades of Glory. For some reason, on that film, I had a giant, full-size trailer with a mini kitchen, wraparound leather couch, and cable TV. I didn't personally ask for this amazing perk. I am assuming I had it because my agents did a fantastic job negotiating for me. So the waiting was bearable, to say the least. I was basically paid to sit and channel surf all day. But most of the time, you won't have that trailer. And neither do I. Most of the time, I have a reasonably comfortable, cable-free, no Wi-Fi, cold little room to sit in while I wait. And it's pretty boring. If you plan on leaving your trailer for any reason, let's say to get a snack, which is totally acceptable, be sure to tell a PA. Find the one that greeted you, or one of the many other PAs on the set. No matter what, be sure someone knows where you are at all times. If you would like a bottle of water, ask the PA. If you need a copy of the sides, ask the PA. If you want to know how to operate the air conditioner or heat in your trailer, ask the PA. You can ask your PA pretty much anything. But a word of advice. The PAs woke up before you, run around all day, eat lunch standing up, and leave well after you. They are the hardest working, lowest paid person on the set. Be kind to them. On set. When you are finally called to set, the first thing you'll do is rehearse. This might be the first time you're meeting the other actors, unless you ran into them at the table read or in the hair and makeup trailer. During rehearsal, everyone holds their sides and reads the scene aloud. After that, you'll start to block it out and get a sense of the movement in the scene. No one expects you to perform the scene at full speed at this point, so don't expect to be given any notes on your acting. This rehearsal is not about your acting performance. It's all about logistics. The director and DP, the director of photography, want to figure out where everyone is sitting, standing, walking, moving, entering, or exiting. It goes quickly. Then, once you set the blocking, they invite the crew to watch a rehearsal. Again, this is really just for logistics. The crew is watching to see where they should set the camera, lights, and sound equipment, so don't feel like you need to perform. After all this, the cast is dismissed. Depending on how long the crew needs to set up, you will either be sent back to your trailer or asked to stay in the cast holding area, a collection of director's chairs on set. Setting of the camera and lights lasts anywhere from 15 to 45 minutes on a TV show. On a movie, it can take several hours, so it's more waiting. I usually walk over to the snack table and peruse the offerings. During this time, the periphery crew will do their work. The sound people will come over and put a microphone on you. The props people will ask which briefcase you want to carry or which watch you want to wear, and so on. Then, once the lighting is done, they'll call you back to the set. You'll usually do one more rehearsal before shooting begins, but this time it will be for camera. This final rehearsal is generally done without scripts, and everyone tries to do it with the same energy as a real take. It will likely be your only real rehearsal of the scene before you start shooting. Next, you will hear someone shout, "Last looks!" which is the signal for the hair, makeup, and wardrobe people to swoop in and touch you up. Once they're done, finally, you will do a take. So, from the time you arrived on set, it's probably around 3 to 4 hours before you actually start acting on camera. Crazy, right? On average, you get about 4 to 5 takes. That's 4 to 5 chances to nail your performance. Many times, a take doesn't work because of a sound issue or a camera issue, so it's important that your performance remain consistent. Getting a great take is a delicate dance between the actors and camera and sound departments. Every element has to work. That said, don't put pressure on yourself to do the entire scene exactly perfect every time. As long as you get a good read on each line at least once, the editor can piece together a good performance. That's the benefit of film and television. It's not live. A general rule for actors is that you should never stop the scene for any reason, especially if you are not one of the leads. Only the director stops the scene. If something obvious happens, if you start choking or someone is having a sneezing fit, please, by all means, stop acting. I remember once on The Office, I was in the middle of a scene with John Krasinski when a lighting gel slowly peeled off above me and landed on top of my head. Now, clearly, we couldn't continue the scene, so it made sense for me to break. But if you or another actor flubs a line, or if you hear a phone ring off camera, don't stop. Keep going until you hear the director yell cut. You'd be surprised how these little distractions or mistakes can bring about a new and interesting element of the performance. Always keep going. When the director feels like you've gotten the scene, you will take a short break while they move the cameras for another angle. Not to sound like a broken record, but I find these breaks are a great time to see what new snacks are on the snack table. You never know what new item may have suddenly appeared. When the lighting break is over, the whole process starts over again until all the shots in that scene are complete. Eventually, you'll hear the assistant director yell, "Cut! Moving on!" This means they are ready to move to the next scene of the day. If you are in it, you will go immediately to rehearse. If you aren't, you'll be sent back to your trailer to wait. And that's your day. Arrive, eat, wardrobe, hair makeup, wait, rehearse, wait snack shoot, wait snack shoot, wait snack shoot, wrap. When I told my actor friend that I was writing this section of the book, she said, "Oh, be sure to tell everyone that a typical shooting day is really slow and boring. You will wait around for hours, and then when it's time to act, everything will move super fast. And then it'll be over, and you feel like you've got no idea what just happened." This made me laugh. It's just so true. Multicamera television. What I just described was a typical workday on a movie or a single-camera television show, like The Office. Things work differently on a multicam television show. This type of show is rehearsed like a play, then taped and performed in front of a live studio audience. An example of a three-camera comedy would be The Big Bang Theory or Everybody Loves Raymond. These are a rare breed nowadays, but they still exist. Their schedule looks something like this. Monday. Do a table read, have wardrobe fittings, and do a hair and makeup test. Tuesday, rehearsals and blocking with the director. Wednesday and Thursday are more rehearsals, including run-throughs for the writers and studio executives, If scenes need to be pre-taped, they happen on Thursday. Friday is tape day. You arrive around noon, do a final rehearsal, eat lunch, and then tape in front of a live audience that evening. I've done a few guest appearances on three-camera comedies, and the schedule can't be beat. Rehearsal days usually start around 10 a.m. and are over by 5. It's the perfect job if you have a family and want to drop your kids off at school and be home to serve them dinner. Throughout the week, you receive rewrites of the script based on your rehearsals. I love this. It's fun. It feels very collaborative. If they are rehearsing a scene you aren't in, there are chairs nearby where everyone sits and watches. On film sets, if you aren't in a scene, you are stuck waiting in some hallway or in your trailer. It's way more fun to watch other actors working than it is to stare at your trailer walls. When I did my gig on Spin City, they pre-taped my restaurant scene. Even though the show was mostly filmed in front of an audience, they occasionally shoot scenes without an audience, mostly due to scheduling issues or set requirements. On my day, we rehearsed and then shot the scene in a matter of a few hours. But I've had other roles on three-camera shows in which I rehearsed throughout the week and shot in front of an audience. It was exhilarating. A great gig if you can get it. Love scenes and fights. Someone once told me the best reason to become an actor is so you can kiss people and shoot guns with no consequences. I've done both things on camera, and I find they produce a strikingly similar experience. In both cases, my palms get sweaty, my heart races, and I wind up feeling a little jazzed afterward. If you get cast in a role that requires doing stunts or love scenes, don't worry. Unlike regular scenes where you rush through the rehearsals, most of the time these types of scenes get special rehearsals and lots of planning, especially stunts. For insurance and safety purposes, studios have to be especially careful about any scenes involving actors and stunt work. There will be a safety officer, a stunt coordinator, and a medic standing by at all times. Even something simple like a shove against a wall or a slap across the face requires elaborate planning to make sure no one gets hurt. I recently did a role where my character had to run into the street to stop a moving car that is barreling toward her. Then, when the driver won't give her a ride, she shoots him and takes the car. So, not only did the scene require me to run into traffic, I also had to shoot a gun. Needless to say, we rehearsed this over and over and over again. The driver of the car was a trained stunt driver. But even after all the rehearsal and the confidence of knowing I was working with a professional driver, I couldn't help but flinch and step backward every time the car got close. It just felt like he wasn't going to stop in time. He did, but it was still pretty scary. Anytime a weapon, such as a gun, is used in a scene, things get serious. Before being given my prop gun, which was actually a real gun loaded with blanks, I received training on how to fire and handle the gun by an on-set weapons specialist. I learned about the kickback involved with firing a handgun and wore tiny flesh-colored earplugs to make sure the sound did not damage my ears. Even though I was firing a blank, it felt and sounded real. As soon as the director yelled cut, the weapons specialist came over and took the gun from me. I wasn't allowed to carry it around or play with it when we weren't shooting, which was fine by me. Great care was taken to make sure everyone remained safe. Love scenes also require special preparation. However, just because you have more elaborate rehearsals, they still tend to happen on the day you shoot the scene. It is very possible that you will shake hands with your co-star and say, "Nice to meet you," and then begin planning an intimate makeout session. A few things you should know about love scenes. No one expects you to kiss for real during rehearsal. As you block out the love scene, it is customary to mime the kissing parts until the camera is rolling. Most of the time, especially on TV, you can get away with stage kissing. This is where you open your mouth but keep your tongue to yourself. Unless the scene clearly calls for something more intimate, stage kissing will usually suffice. That being said, it's customary to brush your teeth and swish some mouthwash before shooting. Or, at the very least, chew some minty gum. I've heard of some actors who use love scenes as an opportunity to informally cheat on their significant others. This is usually in the form of private rehearsals in a trailer. If this offer is made to you, don't be fooled. If you aren't on set with the director, it's not really a rehearsal. Nudity in a scene is something that is disclosed and agreed to before you take on a role. A director or producer should never suddenly pressure you while on set into taking off your clothes. If this is happening to you, calmly excuse yourself and call your agent or SAG representative immediately. I have a no nudity clause in all of my contracts. You can ask for this agreement as well. Nudity clauses are very specific and deal with how much, if any, nudity you will allow. I've heard of actors with nudity clauses that say things like, actor will show top of ass, but not full ass. Or, actress will show side of boob, but not nipple. How's that for specific? Mine says no nudity, so no top of ass or side boob from me. Don't be embarrassed if you get a little excited during a love scene. Even though you are playing a character, your body may not know that you're pretending. You may want to plan ahead for some wind-down time after the scene. There's a good chance your adrenaline will be pumping. Do some yoga, drink some tea, and recenter yourself. No matter whom the scene is with, most likely the other actor is just as nervous as you are. It's a weird and unnatural thing to pretend to be intimate with someone who, more than likely for various reasons, for example, you are both in a relationship with other people, you would not be intimate with in real life. So relax. They probably feel as freaked out as you do. My first big on-camera kissing scene was with John Krasinski when we filmed Jim and Pam's first kiss on The Office. In case you aren't familiar with the show, Jim and Pam were co-workers who had been flirting for 2 seasons. In addition to being my first big on-screen kiss, this was their first kiss, and everyone on the show wanted to get it just right. The writers decided the kiss should take place after a casino-themed work party. In the episode, Jim confronted Pam in the parking lot and told her that he loved her. Pam, feeling guilty for being engaged to someone else, told him that she only thought of him as a friend. Jim was brokenhearted and left. Pam, equally brokenhearted, went back inside and called her mom, confessing her feelings for Jim. Suddenly, Jim entered the office, walked over to Pam, and kissed her. She didn't hesitate and immediately kissed him back. This was obviously a big moment, and it proved what all viewers knew, that Jim and Pam were meant to be together. In the weeks prior to shooting, John and I had long discussions with our director, Ken Kwapis, the writers, and producer, Greg Daniels. I also had private conversations with Ken about how I thought Pam might be feeling in the moments before the kiss and how she might react afterward. We did a lot of prep work, but we didn't officially rehearse the scene until the day of the shoot. The kissing scene was scheduled for the end of our work week, later in the evening after most people were sent home. Only a small crew and a few writers and producers remained. Ken recently told me, "I remember that you and John were off the charts nervous, and I felt it was my job to be as casual about the scene as possible, to undercut how momentous I knew it was." It didn't help matters that on the shooting schedule, the scene description read as follows, "Jim kisses Pam." All caps, italics, and 3 exclamation points. I do remember Ken being rather relaxed when he called John and me to the set for blocking. We decided that I would call my mother from Jim's desk, so my back would be to the door and I wouldn't see John enter. We discussed the kiss. We all agreed it should be simple, mutually savored, but not too elaborate. No tongue required. Yeah, we got that specific. We rehearsed the blocking, but never rehearsed the kiss. Then, the director sent us back to our trailers with strict instructions that we were not to see each other until the scene began. We were separated for at least an hour while they set the camera in a hidden location on the set. Because our characters didn't know this moment was being filmed, Ken didn't want us to see the cameras. He wanted everything to feel as real as possible. After what felt like a lifetime, I was finally called to shoot. The set was dimly lit. I couldn't see any people or cameras. It felt completely real. Ken quietly walked me over to Jim's desk. He told me that he didn't want to yell action because it might take me out of the reality of the scene. Instead, he told me, after he walked away, I should wait a few moments and then start the scene. He assured me the cameras would be rolling. When he walked away, I felt completely transported into a new reality. I was Pam. I was talking with my mother, and my heart was broken.